This is Tax Update for Saturday, January 7th, 2005. Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm any ideas raised in this presentation before relying on the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for use of the document. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is presented by Limeburg Information Services. You can find them on the web at www.limebergservices.com. Limeburg Services offers email newsletters of interest to tax practitioners, also provides a number of other resources available to subscribers on the website. You can find Limeburg Services again at www.limebergservices.com. This week we deal with the new uniform definition of a child and other dependency issues under Section 152. Last year, in the Working Families Tax Relief Act of 2004, Congress changed the definition of a dependent and created what is known as the uniform definition of a child under Section 152. Now, the point of this provision was to give a consistent definition for what is a child for purposes of the Internal Revenue Code, since in many cases we have definitions that vary widely depending upon what context they had been used in. So the point of this was to simplify and make it a little bit more straightforward. In most cases, the results don't change, but in some cases there is significant changes and some significant differences. And as we enter this tax season, it will be important for CPAs to be aware of the fact that they may find clients for whom those differences will occur. If you do enough returns, there's going to be somebody who's going to have a different result than they would have had in the past. There's also some especially important gotchas in special cases that may give you a result that is very different than you had experienced in the past you need to be aware of. And we'll take a look at that as well as we discuss the criteria here. New Section 152 gives us a definition of what is a dependent. And generally, a dependent is going to fall into one of two categories under New 152, as found at 152A. A dependent shall either be a qualifying child or, under 152A2, a qualifying relative. So your dependent falls into one of those two categories. Now, 152B tells us there are certain exceptions that override these rules you need to be aware of. First, if you are a dependent of a taxpayer, you do not have dependents. Under 152B1, dependents are basically ineligible to have dependents. 152B2 tells us the rule we've all become used to, that a married individual has special rules. If a taxpayer shall not be dependent of a taxpayer, if that individual has made a joint return with their spouse. So if person marries another person, they file a joint return. Even if that person would otherwise qualify as a dependent of someone, that person will not be a dependent due to the nature of having filed the joint return. Finally, B3 tells us that a dependent does not include an individual who is not a citizen or national of the United States, unless an individual is either a resident of the United States or a country contiguous to the United States. Read that to mean Mexico and Canada. Now, there is a special exception under B3B for an adopted child, and that shall not exclude any child of a taxpayer if the taxable year of the taxpayer has the same principal place of abode as the taxpayer and is a member of the taxpayer's household, and the taxpayer is a citizen or national of the United States. Now, remembering that, in essence, the exclusion was for somebody who is not a resident of the United States, basically we're looking here for a taxpayer who has an adopted child and who the taxpayer themselves is not residing in the United States. Now, those are the three exclusions, but let's go on now to look at our general definition. Presuming that we have a person that we're looking at and they don't meet any of our exceptions there under Section 152B, we go on to Section 152C to look at the general rule of what is a qualifying child, because we have two categories. So we first test to see, is this individual a qualifying child? And qualifying child is subjected to four tests. First, under 152C1 Cap A, the person must bear a specific relationship. Now we're going to go into what these relationships are, but realize a qualifying child doesn't have to be your child. We'll get on to that later for the relationship. Just also to add to the absurdity of the way tax law works, your child may not be a qualifying child, but may become a qualifying relative. So there's other rules involved in this. The second rule, though, for a qualifying child, assuming it meets the relationship test, the individual must have the same principal place of abode for the taxpayer for more than one half of the taxable year. So a qualifying child has to live with you for over half the year. Simple rule there. C, meets the age requirements of paragraph 3. So there are age requirements we'll discuss for this child. And that individual has not provided over one half of the individual's own support for the calendar year in which the taxable year of the taxpayer begins. Now note, the test there is whether the individual provided over half of their support. Note, no mention in this definition of whether the taxpayer provided over half the support for the individual. That's an important difference now. We're not testing support made by the taxpayer for a qualifying child. We are testing now support made by whether the individual who is the child provided over half of their support. And if not, then we're not going to care about who provided over half the support. We're going to go on and do our test based upon the other rules involved here. Now let's start first with the relationship test. The relationship test breaks into two pieces found at 152C2. The first group makes basic sense, and this is a group you probably expected, a child of the taxpayer or a descendant of the child. So your child and your grandchild, your great-grandchildren, and I suppose you keep going out, they all qualify as child. They can be your qualifying child. B is a little bit more interesting group, and that includes a brother, sister, stepbrother, or stepsister of the taxpayer, or a descendant of any such relative. That means that your brother can be your child. Your sister can be your child, your stepbrother or stepsister. Professor James Maul, in his tax blog, had an interesting case that he gave to his law school class on taxes that discussed the possibility, at least, or raised the possibility, that one's spouse could become one's qualifying child. And the system there involved the issue of when two individuals become married, their parents then, the father of one, the mother of the other, becomes married, so they become stepbrother, stepsister. You create a situation where theoretically a person could, with a file the separate return, that's under the exclusion, could be able to claim their spouse as a dependent. Interesting set of problems there, because it'd be their qualifying child. We'll skip for that. If you're interested in that, you can go to Professor Maul's blog, which you can find by doing a Google search for Mauld again. And it has interesting discussion of this theory, as well as a more general discussion of some of the issues involved in this that he raised with his class on the exam. Now, the second deal was the age requirement we had under C3. And we have two subparts here. We have a general rule. And this general rule gives us two tests, relatively familiar ones, from the old rule. An individual is going to meet the age requirements if they've not attained the age of 19 as the close of the calendar year in which the taxable year of the taxpayer begins. That means on December 31st, this person is 18 years or younger. 18 or younger, that's pretty simple. Or is a student who has not attained the age of 24 as of the close of such calendar year. So we have our full-time student requirement again. The definition of what is a student is found later in Code Section 152, but basically we're back to the full-time student exception for age 24, or age 19. So a qualifying child is either your 18-year-old or younger, or is age 24 or younger and is a full-time student. Now, there is a special rule under C3B for the disabled. In the case of an individual who is permanently and totally disabled, the definition for this will be found in Section 22E3. At any time during the calendar year, the requirements of subparagraph A, meaning the age requirements, shall be treated as met. So if we have a disabled individual, that individual meets the age requirement. That means no matter what their age is, they could still be our qualifying child. They'll have to meet the other requirements, but the age requirement is not going to disqualify them if they are disabled. Now, under C4, as you saw, we had our basic rules here. So we determined who a child is by the fact that we've got the relationship, we share the place of abode, we meet the age requirements, and the individual in question is not provided over half the support. Well, if you look at that list of options, you're going to discover that it's very possible that multiple people could meet it. In fact, depending upon your situation, we could have a whole number of people who are all qualified to claim the child. Simple situation is if we file a married filing separate return for the two parents and they live in the same house, they're both going to qualify to claim the child initially, so we need to have a tiebreaker. We could also have a tiebreaker if the grandparents live in the same house. So again, they share the same place of abode, live there over half the year, it's got the right qualifying relationship. So now we go down the line. Under C4, we find basically the tiebreaker rules. 152C4 tells us what is the tiebreaker. And basically we have under C4A, the general rule. The general rule says we're going to give priority to parents. And what 4A provides, except as provided in subparagraph B, if but for this paragraph, an individual may and his claims qualifying child by two or more taxpayers for a taxable year beginning the same taxable year, such individual shall be treated as a qualifying child of the taxpayer who is a parent of the individual, or if clause 1 does not apply, the taxpayer with the highest adjusted gross income for such taxable year. So basically, we have two basic clauses here with parents getting priority. So the parent picks up the priority for the child. Now, under C4B, we have more than one parent who claims the child. If the parents claiming any qualified child do not file a joint return together, such child shall be treated as a qualifying child of the parent with whom the child resided the longest period of time during the taxable year, or if the child resides with both parents for the same amount of time during such taxable year, the parent with the highest adjusted gross income. So our tiebreaker ends up going based on AGI. Now, an interesting clause here, when you note above the way the definition said an individual may be and is claimed by two or more taxpayers, does raise the suggestion that potentially we could look at an issue of whether somebody leaves them off, is that good enough? Not totally clear how this is going to read and work out. Could be a very interesting moving forward. But it could create a problem if we interpret this to say that both parties basically end up having the option, and the option becomes, therefore, if they don't agree, we go to highest AGI, or the IRS could take the position that you can only be a qualifying child if you would qualify if everybody had claimed. Don't know if they'll take that position or not. Hopefully not, because I don't know the law is literally written going to support that. But it does raise some issues in states like Ohio, where there is a state law reason we would like to claim the child as a dependent on the return of various, or whether I should say where we want to file separate returns, because state law gives a break potentially if we file married filing separate, but requires us to have the same filing status as federal. So for federal purposes, we file married separate. For state purposes, we can get a much bigger tax benefit than any loss we'd have at the federal level. But that could be changed by this AGI rule, and we're going to need to watch out for this particular issue. But again, at least there appears to be an argument, as I read, reviewing C4A, an argument that as long as you don't claim, perhaps we can escape the application of this provision as far as the test for AGI, but we will have to look going forward. Now, 152D now, we presume we don't have a qualifying child. Now we look at a qualifying relative. A qualifying relative ends up with an interesting amount of four tests again. Slightly different four tests than we had for a child, but we have someone who's not a qualifying child, so now we test for a qualifying relative. We have to bear a relationship to the taxpayer described in paragraph 2 of 152D. Well, we'll talk about that list of who's in. Has gross income less than the exemption amount? Again, now we've got to be below the exemption amount for the year or the person is not qualified. That rule sounds very familiar. C, with respect to whom the taxpayer provides over half of the individual support for the calendar year in which the taxable year begins. Again, Similar rule to what we've had before. In this case, we do test. If I'm going to claim a dependent who is not my qualifying child, I have to be able to show I provide over half the support. Or we'll get to the multiple support agreements issues coming up later. But basically, the support test is there. And who is not a qualifying child of such taxpayer or of any other taxpayer for any taxable year beginning in the calendar year in which such taxable year begins. So if someone is a qualifying child of someone else, you lose the dependency exemption even if you provide over half of that individual's support. Now, what are the relationships? Well, the relationship list makes sense. It comes from the old law, pretty much. And the relationships that count that we can use include a child or a descendant of a child, a brother, sister, stepbrother, or stepsister. Notice the first two are the same definition we had for a qualifying child. So this is a person who failed the qualifying child test, but not due to the relationship. Now we get to the expansion of this list. The father or mother or an ancestor of either, a stepfather or stepmother, a son or daughter of a brother or sister of the taxpayer, a brother or sister of the father or mother of the taxpayer, so it means your aunt and uncle, a son-in-law, daughter-in-law, father-in-law, mother-in-law, brother-in-law, or sister-in-law. All the in-laws work. And then finally, the generic catch-all category. This is for someone who is not related to you in a manner that any of the above is caught. An individual who at any time during the taxable year was the spouse, determined without regard to Section 7703 of the taxpayer, who for the taxable year of the taxpayer has the same principal place of abode of the taxpayer and is a member of the taxpayer's household. So this is the test for somebody unrelated who lives with you, who you're going to claim the dependency exemption for. Now again, note, this requires the same principal place of abode and is a member of your household for that particular year. Now, D3 gives us the special rules relating to multiple support agreements, and basically those are pretty much as we've had before. Over one half of support shall be treated as being received from the taxpayer if no person contributed over one half of the support, and over half of the support received by two or more persons, each of whom, but for the fact the person did alone did not contribute over one half of the support, would have been entitled to claim such individual as a dependent for a taxable year beginning in such calendar year. The taxpayer in question contributed over 10% of such support, and each person who provided over 10% of such report files a written declaration with the secretary that such person will not claim an individual as a dependent. So basically, you can agree among the group if we have a group providing the support for someone who, again, remember, cannot be a qualifying child of someone else. So if there's a qualifying child in this mix, we're back to the support didn't matter. But we have someone who's not a qualifying child of any individual. We have multiple support agreement. We can still divide that up. Now, 152D4 provides a special rule to income of handicap information. And that gives us a special rule if you have a handicap dependent, again, as defined by 22E3, shall not include income attributable to services performed by the individual at a sheltered workshop if the availability of medical care at such workshop is the principal reason for the individual's presence there, and the income arises solely from activities at such workshop which are incident to such medical care. And there's a definition of what is a sheltered workshop. Basically provide special instruction or training designed to alleviate the disability individual and which is operated by a 501c3 organization exempt from tax under 501a or by a state possession of the United States, political subdivision of the foregoing, the United States, or the District of Columbia, basically a governmental agency. Now, there are special rules under D5 for support. Payments to a spouse or includable gross income of such spouse under Section 71 or 682 shall not be treated by a payment by the payor or spouse for the support of any dependent. You can't count your alimony payment as being paid for the dependent. And in the case of remarriage of a parent, support of a child received from the parent's spouse shall be treated as received from the parent. So again, if there's a remarriage of the parent, support of the child received from your spouse shall count as if it came from the parent. So you remarry, your spouse provides support for a child, again, non-qualifying child, then that counts as your support. The special rule for parents who are divorced continues in this law under the new provision. But there was a twist, and there's an interesting issue that arose in the initial law and which Congress has now reversed in the recently passed Gulf Opportunity Zone Act of 2005. So we'll discuss both the issue and the reversal, because the initial issue we discussed in an earlier podcast, and we discussed there the fact that this change in 152 had the potential to change the parent who would receive the dependency exemption based solely upon a divorce decree. Congress apparently had second thoughts and now wants a do-over, and so they've essentially set the law back to what it was. If you remember from that earlier podcast, we had discussed the fact under 152E2A, what then was little I, which now doesn't exist anymore, there was going to essentially be that if the degree of divorce provided that you shall be entitled to a deduction, then that was good enough to get you the exemption even if the non-custodial parent did not sign over the exemption. Well, in the Gulf Opportunity Zone Act of 2005, Congress retroactively changed this language, and they changed it basically effective back to the first day. So we're now under a rule that is going to be much closer to what we had before. And the new E2A simply says the custodial parent signs a written declaration in such manner informs the secretary by regulations prescribed that such custodial parent will not claim such a child as a dependent for any taxable year beginning in such calendar year. That's 152E2A. And then E2B, the non-custodial parent attaches such written declaration to the non-custodial parent's tax return. So now, after going round and round on this issue before, we're back to the same old thing we had before. We need the written document. Now, because of this, it raises interest in the old case that we discussed previously in the earlier podcast reference in the materials, where the tax court, in a summary opinion, had decided that a taxpayer was eligible to claim the dependency exemption. And that was a case of Oman versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary 2005-110. We may now have more interest in that case because, obviously, we're now back to the same old rule, and the question becomes, could a decree suffice as the written document? The caveat I would add, Oman is what I would call a proof of concept case. It shows it is possible to prevail. It does not show it will be easy or that it will be something that will happen very often without that written document. The Oman case is based on a number of unique facts that made the non-custodial parent a very sympathetic individual in front of the court and made the custodial parent appear highly unsympathetic. So the court got to the decision that the non-custodial parent could claim the exemption even though literally the 8332 did not exist and was not signed. That's not a result that's likely to be duplicated easily in any other format. So be aware and be very careful, but do take a look at Oman. In the right case, you may still have some argument, but you've got an extreme uphill fight in that manner. I would also mention in passing, don't forget that nowhere in 152 do we find the rule that the IRS operates under for electronic filing. That is, there is nothing in the law that says the first person to file gets to claim the child. Now, unfortunately, the IRS's e-filing methods have encouraged this to be considered the rule or made many people believe it is the rule. And so there shall be in the next few weeks a rush to file among parents who are divorced to see who gets in first to claim the child. But realize that under the code, that rule does not exist. What it does mean as a practical matter, unfortunately, is that if you are the second parent in, you have the right to claim the child under the law, which is simple. If you're custodial and you've not signed away your rights, you have the right. You're going to have to essentially file a paper return and then go through the process of disputing it. That is still an issue and, quite frankly, to me, is a system that encourages fraud in the IRS e-filing system, but they're not asking me for my ideas on how to change it, so we'll continue on and keep going forward. Now, as noted, there is an exception under E3 for pre-1985 instruments because very few of those are going to be involved in this particular world any longer. Most kids aren't at that, or who are around 1985 are now old enough and not dependents any longer. It's going to apply in special cases for disabled children. You may want to take a look at that and see if you have certain issues if that arises. But otherwise, I'm going to skip over E3 and the pre-85 agreements because I think for most of us, it's simply not going to be an issue. Now, 152F has other definitions and rules. And of course, we said basically, what is a child, F1? Well, we had the basic rule, but a child includes a son, daughter, stepson, stepdaughter, taxpayer, or an eligible foster child. It notes for adopted children under F1B that determining whether any of the relationships exists, a legally adopted individual of the taxpayer, an individual who is lawfully placed with the taxpayer for legal adoption, shall be treated as a child of the individual by blood. And an eligible foster child, F1C, means an individual who is placed with a taxpayer by an authorized placement agency or by judgment, decree, or order of any court or competent jurisdiction. So there is an expansion here of the definition of a child beyond the mere biological children list. So be involved with that when you're looking at the definition of what is a child under F1. F2 tells us a student, and what is a student? Remember, that was important for qualified child. It means an individual who during each of 5 calendar months during the year in which the taxpayer begins is a full-time student in an educational institution, or is pursuing a full-time course of institutional on-farm training under supervision of an accredited agent of an educational institution of a state or political subdivision of the state. So if you need to know if someone is a student, there's the basic rule. The basic rule is you need to be a full-time student for 5 months during the year and you are a student. Again, the age 24 test involves there. A determination of household status is found in F3. An individual should not be treated as a member of the taxpayer's household if at any time during the taxable year of the taxpayer, the relationship between such individual and the taxpayer is in violation of local law. This is the living in sin rule, shall we say. Therefore, if you have a relationship that is in violation of local law, you cannot claim the dependent. You will not be a member of your household. Remember that we had a member of household test in a couple of places. Most normally, though, this comes up as mentioned in the living in sin context, where a taxpayer has a unmarried individual. They are an unmarried couple living together. That's not going to allow the individual to claim the dependency exemption for their significant other. Now, F4 tells us brother and sister include a brother or sister by half-blood. Okay, that's useful, I guess, for our definition. There is a special rule under F5 support test in the case of students for the purposes of C1D and D1C. An individual who is a child of a taxpayer and a student's amount to receive a scholarship for study shall not be taken into account. Now, remember, if you're a qualifying child and you're a student under age 24, we didn't care what your income level was. So basically, for support, they didn't care about the support issue. So this is for the qualifying relative who is not a qualifying child would be where these become important. Treatment of missing children solely for purposes, a child of the taxpayer who is presumed by law enforcement to have been kidnapped by someone who is not a member of the family of such child or taxpayer and who had for the taxable year in which kidnapping occurred, the same principal place of abode of the taxpayer more than half the portion of the year, shall be treated as meeting the requirements of C1B with respect to the taxpayers for all taxable years ending during the period in which the child is kidnapped. So basically, if you have a kidnapped child, you are deemed to have met the requirements found at C1B, and the requirement found at C1B is the requirement for being a member of the household of the individual for the qualifying child test. So basically, it allows us to do this. Now, it does have restrictions on this purpose for when this is going to count. Remember, this is a uniform definition of a child and is brought in under certain rules. There's also comparable treatment of certain qualifying relatives. A child taxpayer is presumed by law enforcement. This is under F6CI. And who's a qualifying relative gets the treatment similarly. And the termination of the treatment, these shall cease to apply as the first half of the year of the taxpayer beginning after the calendar year in which there is a termination child is dead, or if earlier when the child would have attained age 18. Now, these are all interesting side provisions. Now, notice, as this was a uniform definition of a child, we also should note that under the dependency exemption, we have a few cross-references here that become involved. The references for the head of household status under section 2B1A little I have been updated to reflect these definitions. The dependent care credit under section 21 was modified to say that if all requirements are met, taxpayers may claim the credit for a qualifying individual who lived with the taxpayer over half the year, even if that individual does not provide over half support of the individual, and a disabled dependent or spouse of the taxpayer will have to have the same principal resident of the taxpayer claiming the credit for more than half the year, and the living arrangement cannot be in violation of local law. The child credit now references the uniform definition of a child, except the requirement the child be under age 17 remains, and the earned income credit has been modified to now reference this uniform definition, with two significant differences. For earned income credit, the requirement that the child not provide over half of his or her support is eliminated. And second, if the custodial parent has released the exemption, the child is a qualifying child of the custodial parent for earned income credit purposes. So it's a child whose exemption has been released. We still can get the credit for earned income credit purposes. We get the child for that purpose. Now, as noted, we have a number of interesting changes, and in fact, recent change now that has changed the change we had been worried about with the divorced parents. So it is important to review these issues and realize we are operating under slightly different rules coming into this year under Section 152. This has been Tax Update. The Tax Update, again, is intended for those who can do their own independent research to verify these positions. Please do not rely on these positions without doing your own independent verification. This podcast is brought to you by Limeburg Services. They can be found at www.limeburgservices.com. Who give email lists and email subscription lists and other materials available that are of interest to tax practitioners. You can find out about their subscription options at www.limeburgservices.com. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, January 7th, 2005.